lovers squabbling under a tree, the domestic family life of the parks. Never had he seen London look so enchanting. The softness of the distances, the richness, the greenness. The civilization after India, he thought, strolling across the grass. He could see the first moment they came into the room. The Warren Smiths, they were called. He was certain, directly he saw the man. It was a case of extreme gravity. It was a case of complete breakdown. Complete physical and nervous breakdown, with every symptom in an advanced stage, he ascertained in 2 or 3 minutes, writing answers to questions, murmured discreetly, on a pink card. How long had Dr. Holmes been attending him? 6 weeks. Prescribed a little bromide? Said there was nothing the matter? Ah, yes. Those general practitioners, thought Sir William. It took half his time to undo their blunders. Some were irreparable. You served with great distinction in the war? The patient repeated the word war interrogatively. He was attaching meanings to words of a symbolical kind, a serious symptom to be noted on the card. The war? The patient asked. The European war, that little shindy of schoolboys with gunpowder. Had he served with distinction? He really forgot. In the war itself, he had failed. Yes, he served with the greatest distinction, Rezia assured the doctor. He was promoted. And they have the very highest opinion of you at your office, Sir William murmured, glancing at Mr. Brewer's very generously worded letter. So that you have nothing to worry you, no financial anxiety, nothing. He had committed an appalling crime and been condemned to death by human nature. I have, he began, committed a crime. He has done nothing wrong whatever, Rezia assured the doctor. If Mr. Smith would wait, said Sir William, he would speak to Mrs. Smith in the next room. Her husband was very seriously ill, Sir William said. Did he threaten to kill himself? Oh, he did, she cried. But he did not mean it, she said. Oh, of course not. It was merely a question of rest, said Sir William. Of rest, rest, rest. A long rest in bed. There was a delightful home down in the country where her husband would be perfectly looked after. Away from her? She asked. Unfortunately, yes. The people we care for most are not good for us when we're ill. But he was not mad, was he? Sir William said he never spoke of madness. He called it not having a sense of proportion. But her husband did not like doctors. He would refuse to go there. Shortly and kindly, Sir William explained to her the state of the case. He had threatened to kill himself. There was no alternative. It was a question of law. He would lie in bed in a beautiful house in the country. The nurses were admirable. Sir William would visit him once a week. If Mrs. Warren Smith was quite sure she had no more questions to ask, he never hurried his patients, they would return to her husband. She had nothing more to ask, not of Sir William. So they returned to the most exalted of mankind, the criminal who faced his judges, the victim exposed on the heights, the fugitive, the drowned sailor, the poet of the immortal ode, the Lord who had gone from life to death, to Septimus Warren Smith, who sat in the armchair under the skylight, staring at a photograph of Lady Bradshaw in court dress, muttering messages about beauty. "We've had our little talk," said Sir William. "He says you are very, very ill," Rezia cried. "We have been arranging that you should go into a home," said Sir William. "One of Holmes's homes," sneered Septimus. The fellow made a distasteful impression, for there was in Sir William, whose father had been a tradesman, A natural respect for breeding and clothing, which shabbiness nettled. Again, more profoundly, there was in Sir William, who had never had time for reading, a grudge, deeply buried, against cultivated people who came into his room and intimated that doctors, whose profession is a constant strain upon all the highest faculties, are not educated men. One of the triumphs of civilization, Peter Walsh thought. It is one of the triumphs of civilization, as the light high bell of the ambulance sounded. Swiftly, cleanly, the ambulance sped to the hospital, having picked up instantly, humanely, some poor devil. Someone hit on the head, struck down by disease, knocked over perhaps a minute or so ago at one of these crossings, as might happen to oneself. That was civilization. It struck him, coming back from the East, the efficiency, the organization, the communal spirit of London. Every cart or carriage of its own accord drew aside to let the ambulance pass. Perhaps it was morbid. Or was it not touching, rather, the respect which they showed this ambulance with its victim inside, busy men hurrying home, yet instantly bethinking them, as it passed, of some wife, or presumably how easily it might have been them there, stretched on a shelf with a doctor and a nurse. Ah, but thinking became morbid, sentimental, directly one began conjuring up doctors, dead bodies. A little glow of pleasure, a sort of lust, too, over the visual impression, warned one not to go on with that sort of thing any more. Fatal to art, fatal to friendship. True. And yet, thought Peter Walsh, as the ambulance turned the corner, though the light high bell could be heard down the next street, and still farther as it crossed the Tottenham Court Road, chiming constantly. It is the privilege of loneliness. In privacy, one may do as one chooses. One might weep if no one saw. It had been his undoing, this susceptibility, in Anglo-Indian society, not weeping at the right time, or laughing either. I have that in me, he thought, standing by the pillar box, which could now dissolve in tears. Why, heaven knows. Beauty of some sort, probably, and the weight of the day, which, beginning with that visit to Clarissa, had exhausted him with its heat, its intensity, and the drip, drip of one impression after another down into that cellar where they stood, deep, dark, and no one would ever know. Partly for that reason, its secrecy, complete and inviolable, he had found life like an unknown garden, full of turns and corners. Surprising, yes. Really, it took one's breath away, these moments. There, coming to him by the pillar box opposite the British Museum, one of them, a moment in which things came together, this ambulance and life and death. It was as if he were sucked up to some very high roof by that rush of emotion, and the rest of him, like a white, shell-sprinkled beach, left bare. It had been his undoing in Anglo-Indian society, this susceptibility. Clarissa once, going on top of an omnibus with him somewhere, Clarissa, superficially at least, so easily moved, now in despair, now in the best of spirits, all a quiver in those days, and such good company, spotting queer little scenes, names, people from the top of a bus, for they used to explore London and bring back bags full of treasures from the Caledonian market. Clarissa had a theory in those days. They had heaps of theories, always theories, as young people have. It was to explain the feeling they had of dissatisfaction, not knowing people, not being known. For how could they know each other? You met every day, then not for 6 months or years. It was unsatisfactory, they agreed, how little one knew people. But, she said, sitting on the bus going up Shaftesbury Avenue, she felt herself everywhere. Not here, 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 and she tapped the back of the seat, but everywhere. She waved her hand going up Shaftesbury Avenue. She was all that. So that to know her, or anyone, one must seek out the people who completed them, even the places. Odd affinities she had with people she had never spoken to, some woman in the street, some man behind a counter, even trees or barns. It ended in a transcendental theory, which, with her horror of death, allowed her to believe, or say that she believed, for all her scepticism, that since our apparitions, the part of us which appears, are so momentary compared with the other, the unseen part of us which spreads wide, the unseen might survive, be recovered somehow attached to this person or that, or even haunting certain places after death. Perhaps. Perhaps. Not that they added perceptibly to the noise of the party. They were not talking, perceptibly, as they stood side by side by the yellow curtains. They would soon be off elsewhere, together, and never had very much to say in any circumstances. They looked. That was enough. They looked so clean, so sound, she with an apricot bloom of powder and paint, but he scrubbed, rinsed, with the eyes of a bird, so that no ball could pass him or stroke surprise him. He struck, he leapt accurately on the spot. Ponies' mouths quivered at the end of his reins. He had his honours, ancestral monuments, banners hanging in the church at home. He had his duties, his tenants, a mother and sisters, had been all day at Lord's, and that was what they were talking about, cricket, cousins, the movies, when Mrs. Dalloway came up. Lord Gayton liked her most awfully. So did Miss Blow. She had such charming manners. "It is angelic. It is delicious of you to have come," she said. She loved Lord's. She loved youth. And Nancy, dressed at enormous expense by the greatest artist in Paris, stood there looking as if her body had merely put forth, of its own accord, a green frill. "I had meant to have dancing," said Clarissa. For the young people could not talk, and why should they? Shout, embrace, swing, be up at dawn, carry sugar to ponies, kiss and caress the snouts of adorable chows, and then, all tingling and streaming, plunge and swim. But the enormous resources of the English language, the power it bestows, after all, of communicating feelings, at their age she and Peter would have been arguing all the evening, was not for them. They would solidify young. They would be good beyond measure to the people on the estate, but alone, perhaps, rather dull. "What a pity," she said. "I had hoped to have dancing. It was so extraordinarily nice of them to have come. But talk of dancing, the rooms were packed. There was old Aunt Helena in her shawl. Alas, she must leave them, Lord Gayton and Nancy Blow. There was old Miss Parry, her aunt." But Lucrezia herself couldn't help looking at the motor car and the tree pattern on the blinds. Was it the Queen in there? The Queen going shopping? The chauffeur, who had been opening something, turning something, shutting something, got on to the box. "Come on," said Lucrezia. But her husband, for they had been married 4, 5 years now, jumped, started, and said, "All right," angrily, as if she had interrupted him. People must notice. People must see. People, she thought, looking at the crowd staring at the motor car. The English people, with their children and their horses and their clothes, which she admired in a way. But they were people now, because Septimus had said, "I will kill myself." An awful thing to say. Suppose they had heard him. She looked at the crowd. "Help! Help!" she wanted to cry out to butchers' boys and women. "Help!" Only last autumn she and Septimus had stood on the embankment, wrapped in the same cloak, and Septimus reading a paper instead of talking, she had snatched it from him and laughed in the old man's face who saw them. But failure one conceals. She must take him away into some park. "Now we will cross," she said. She had a right to his arm, though it was without feeling. He would give her, who was so simple, so impulsive, only 24, without friends in England, who had left Italy for his sake, a piece of bone. The motor car, with its blinds drawn and an air of inscrutable reserve, proceeded towards Piccadilly, still gazed at, still ruffling the faces on both sides of the street with the same dark breath of veneration, whether for Queen, Prince, or Prime Minister, nobody knew. The face itself had been seen only once by three people for a few seconds. Even the sex was now in dispute. But there could be no doubt that greatness was seated within. Greatness was passing, hidden, down Bond Street, removed only by a hand's breadth from ordinary people, who might now, for the first and last time, be within speaking distance of the majesty of England, of the enduring symbol of the state which will be known to curious antiquaries, sifting the ruins of time, when London is a grass-grown path, and all those hurrying along the pavement this Wednesday morning are but bones, with a few wedding rings mixed up in their dust, and the gold stoppings of innumerable decayed teeth. The face in the motor car will then be known. "It's probably the Queen," thought Mrs. Dalloway, coming out of Mulberry's with her flowers. "The Queen." And for a second she wore a look of extreme dignity, standing by the flower shop in the sunlight, while the car passed at a foot's pace, with its blinds drawn. "The Queen going to some hospital." "The Queen opening some bazaar," thought Clarissa. "Do you remember the lake?" she said, in an abrupt voice, under the pressure of an emotion which caught her heart, made the muscles of her throat stiff, and contracted her lips in a spasm as she said lake. For she was a child, throwing bread to the ducks between her parents, and at the same time a grown woman coming to her parents who stood by the lake, holding her life in her arms, which, as she neared them, grew larger and larger in her arms, until it became a whole life, a complete life, which she put down by them and said, "This is what I have made of it, this." And what had she made of it? What, indeed, sitting there sewing this morning with Peter? She looked at Peter Walsh. Her look, passing through all that time and that emotion, reached him doubtfully, settled on him tearfully, and rose and fluttered away as a bird touches a branch and rises and flutters away. Quite simply, she wiped her eyes. "Yes," said Peter. "Yes, yes, yes," he said, as if she drew up to the surface something which positively hurt him as it rose. "Stop! Stop!" he wanted to cry. For he was not old, his life was not over, not by any means. He was only just past 50. "Shall I tell her," he thought, "or not?" He would like to make a clean breast of it all. "But she is too cold," he thought, sewing with her scissors. "Daisy would look ordinary beside Clarissa. And she would think me a failure, which I am in their sense," he thought, "in the Dalloways' sense." Oh, yes, he had no doubt about that. He was a failure compared with all this, the inlaid table, the mounted paper knife, the dolphin and the candlesticks, the chair covers and the old valuable English-tinted prints. He was a failure. "I detest the smugness of the whole affair," he thought. "Richard's doing, not Clarissa's, save that she married him." Here Lucy came into the room, carrying silver, more silver, but charming, slender, graceful she looked, he thought, as she stooped to put it down. "And this has been going on all the time," he thought, "week after week, Clarissa's life, while I," he thought, and at once everything seemed to radiate from him, journeys, rides, quarrels, adventures, bridge parties, love affairs, work, work, work. And he took out his knife quite openly, his old horn-handled knife, which Clarissa could swear he had had these 30 years, and clenched his fist upon it. This susceptibility to impressions had been his undoing, no doubt. Still, at his age, he had, like a boy or a girl even, these alternations of mood, Good days, bad days, for no reason whatever. Happiness from a pretty face, downright misery at the sight of a frump. After India, of course, one fell in love with every woman one met. There was a freshness about them. Even the poorest dressed better than 5 years ago, surely. And to his eye, the fashions had never been so becoming. The long black cloaks, the slimness, the elegance. And then the delicious and apparently universal habit of paint. Every woman, even the most respectable, had roses blooming under glass, lips cut with a knife, curls of Indian ink. There was design, art, everywhere. A change of some sort had undoubtedly taken place. What do the young people think about? Peter Walsh asked himself. Those 5 years, 1918 to 1923, had been, he suspected, somehow very important. People looked different. Newspapers seemed different. Now, for instance, there was a man writing quite openly in one of the respectable weeklies about water closets. That you couldn't have done 10 years ago, written quite openly about water closets in a respectable weekly. And then there's taking out a stick of rouge or a powder puff and making up in public. On board ship, coming home, there were lots of young men and girls, Betty and Bertie, he remembered in particular, carrying on quite openly. The old mother sitting and watching them with her knitting, cool as a cucumber. The girl would stand still and powder her nose in front of everyone. And they weren't engaged, just having a good time, no feelings hurt on either side. As hard as nails she was, Betty what's her name, but a thorough good sort. She would make a very good wife at 30. She would marry when it suited her to marry, marry some rich man and live in a large house near Manchester. Who was it now who had done that? Peter Walsh asked himself, turning into the broad walk. Married a rich man and lived in a large house near Manchester. Somebody who had written him a long, gushing letter quite lately about blue hydrangeas. It was seeing blue hydrangeas that made her think of him and the old days. Sally Seton, of course. It was Sally Seton. The last person in the world one would have expected to marry a rich man and live in a large house near Manchester. The wild, the daring, the romantic Sally. But of all that ancient lot, Clarissa's friends, Whitbreads, Kinderleys, Cunninghams, Kinlock Joneses, Sally was probably the best. She tried to get hold of things by the right end, anyhow. She saw through Hugh Whitbread, anyhow, the admirable Hugh, when Clarissa and the rest were at his feet. The Whitbreads, he could hear her saying. Who are the Whitbreads? Coal merchants, respectable tradespeople. One of my homes, Mr. Warren Smith, he said, where we will teach you to rest. And there was just one thing more. He was quite certain that when Mr. Warren Smith was well, he was the last person in the world to frighten his wife. But he had talked of killing himself. We all have our moments of depression, said Sir William. Once you fall, Septimus repeated to himself, human nature is on you. Holmes and Bradshaw are on you. They scour the desert. They fly screaming into the wilderness. The rack and the thumbscrew are applied. Human nature is remorseless. Impulses came upon him sometimes? Sir William asked, with his pencil on a pink card. That was his own affair, said Septimus. Nobody lives for himself alone, said Sir William, glancing at the photograph of his wife in court dress. And you have a brilliant career before you, said Sir William. There was Mr. Brewer's letter on the table. An exceptionally brilliant career. But if he confessed, if he communicated, would they let him off then, his torturers? I, he stammered. But what was his crime? He couldn't remember it. Yes, Sir William encouraged him, but it was growing late. Love, trees, there is no crime. What was his message? He couldn't remember it. I, Septimus stammered. Try to think as little about yourself as possible, said Sir William kindly. Really, he wasn't fit to be about. Was there anything else they wished to ask him? Sir William would make all arrangements, he murmured to Rizzia, and he would let her know between 5 and 6 that evening, he murmured. Trust everything to me, he said, and dismissed them. Never, never had Rizzia felt such agony in her life. She had asked for help and been deserted. He had failed them. So William Bradshaw was not a nice man. The upkeep of that motor car alone must cost him quite a lot, said Septimus when they got out into the street. She clung to his arm. They had been deserted. But what more did she want? To his patience he gave 3/4 of an hour. And if in this exacting science, which has to do with what, after all, we know nothing about, the nervous system, the human brain, a doctor loses his sense of proportion, as a doctor he fails. Health we must have, and health is proportion. So that when a man comes into your room and says he is Christ, a common delusion, and has a message, as they mostly have, and threatens, as they often do, to kill himself, you invoke proportion. Order rest in bed, rest in solitude, silence and rest. Rest without friends, without books, without messages. 6 months rest. Until a man who went in weighing 7 stone 6 comes out weighing 12. Proportion, divine proportion, Sir William's goddess, was acquired by Sir William walking hospitals, catching salmon, begetting one son in Harley Street by Lady Bradshaw, who caught salmon herself and took photographs scarcely to be distinguished from the work of professionals. Worshipping proportion, Sir William not only prospered himself, but made England prosper, secluded her lunatics, forbade childbirth, penalised despair, made it impossible for the unfit to propagate their views until they, too, shared his sense of proportion. His, if they were men, Lady Bradshaw's, if they were women. She embroidered, knitted, spent 4 nights out of 7 at home with her son. So that not only did his colleagues respect him, his subordinates fear him, but the friends and relations of his patients felt for him the keenest gratitude for insisting that these prophetic Christs and Christesses, who prophesied the end of the world or the advent of God, should drink milk in bed, as Sir William ordered. Sir William, with his 30 years' experience of these kinds of cases, and his infallible instinct, this is madness, this sense, in fact, his sense of proportion. Looking back over that long friendship of almost 30 years, her theory worked to this extent. Brief, broken, often painful as their actual meetings had been, what with his absences and interruptions. This morning, for instance, in came Elizabeth, like a long-legged colt, handsome, dumb, just as he was beginning to talk to Clarissa. The effect of them on his life was immeasurable. There was a mystery about it. You were given a sharp, acute, uncomfortable grain, the actual meeting, horribly painful, as often as not. Yet in absence, in the most unlikely places, it would flower out, open, shed its scent, let you touch, taste, look about you, get the whole feel of it and understanding after years of lying lost. Thus she had come to him, on board ship, in the Himalayas, suggested by the oddest things. So Sally Seaton, generous, enthusiastic goose, thought of him when she saw blue hydrangeas. She had influenced him more than any person he had ever known. And always, in this way, coming before him without his wishing it, cool, ladylike, critical, or ravishing, romantic, recalling some field or English harvest. He saw her most often in the country, Not in London. One scene after another at Boughton. He had reached his hotel. He crossed the hall, with its mounds of reddish chairs and sofas, its spike-leaved, withered-looking plants. He got his key off the hook. The young lady handed him some letters. He went upstairs. He saw her most often at Boughton in the late summer, when he stayed there for a week, or fortnight even, as people did in those days. First, on top of some hill, there she would stand, hands clapped to her hair, her cloak blowing out, pointing, crying to them. She saw the Severn beneath, or in a wood, making the kettle boil, very ineffective with her fingers, the smoke curtsying, blowing in their faces, her little pink face showing through, begging water from an old woman in a cottage who came to the door to watch them go. They walked, always. The others drove. She was bored driving, disliked all animals except that dog. They tramped miles along roads. She would break off to get her bearings, pilot him back across country. And all the time they argued, discussed poetry, discussed people, discussed politics. She was a radical then. Never noticing a thing, except when she stopped, cried out at a view or a tree, and made him look with her. And so on again, through stubble fields, she walking ahead with a flower for her aunt, never tired of walking for all her delicacy, to drop down on Boughton in the dusk. Then, after dinner, old Breitkopf would open the piano and sing without any voice, and they would lie sunk in armchairs, trying not to laugh, but always breaking down and laughing, laughing, laughing at nothing. Breitkopf was supposed not to see. And then in the morning, flirting up and down like a wagtail in front of the house. Oh, it was a letter from her. This blue envelope, that was her hand. And he would have to read it. Here was another of those meetings, bound to be painful. To read her letter needed the devil of an effort. How heavenly it was to see him. She must tell him that. That was all. But it upset him. It annoyed him. He wished she hadn't written it. Coming on top of his thoughts, it was like a nudge in the ribs. Why couldn't she let him be? After all, she had married Dalloway and lived with him in perfect happiness all these years. For Miss Helena Parry was not dead. Miss Parry was alive. She was past 80. She ascended staircases slowly with a stick. She was placed in a chair. Richard had seen to it. And people who had known Burma in the 70s were always led up to her. Where had Peter got to? They used to be such friends. For at the mention of India, or even Ceylon, her eyes, only one was glass, slowly deepened, became blue, beheld not human beings. She had no tender memories, no proud illusions about viceroys, generals, mutinies. It was orchids she saw, and mountain passes, and herself carried on the backs of coolies in the 60s over solitary peaks, or descending to uproot orchids, startling blossoms never beheld before, which she painted in watercolour. An indomitable Englishwoman, fretful if disturbed by the war, say, which dropped a bomb at her very door, from her deep meditation over orchids, and her own figure journeying in the 60s in India. But here was Peter. "Come and talk to Aunt Helena about Burma," said Clarissa. And yet he had not had a word with her all the evening. "We'll talk later," said Clarissa, leading him up to Aunt Helena in her white shawl with her stick. "Peter Walsh," said Clarissa. That meant nothing. Clarissa had asked her. It was tiring, it was noisy, but Clarissa had asked her, so she had come. It was a pity that they lived in London, Richard and Clarissa. If only for Clarissa's health, it would have been better to live in the country. But Clarissa had always been fond of society. "He's been in Burma," said Clarissa. Ah! She could not resist recalling what Charles Darwin had said about her little book on the orchids of Burma. Clarissa must speak to Lady Bruton. No doubt it was forgotten now, her book on the orchids of Burma, but it went into 3 editions before 1870, she told Peter. She remembered him now. He had been at Boughton. And he had left her, Peter Walsh remembered, without a word in the drawing-room that night when Clarissa had asked him to come boating. "Richard so much enjoyed his lunch-party," said Clarissa to Lady Bruton. "Richard was the greatest possible help," Lady Bruton replied. "He helped me to write a letter. And how are you?" "Oh, perfectly well," said Clarissa. Lady Bruton detested illness in the wives of politicians. "And there's Peter Walsh," said Lady Bruton, for she could never think of anything to say to Clarissa, though she liked her. She had lots of fine qualities, but they had nothing in common, she and Clarissa. It might have been better if Richard had married a woman with less charm, who would have helped him more in his work. He had lost his chance of the cabinet. "There's Peter Walsh," she said, shaking hands with that agreeable sinner, that very able fellow who should have made a name for himself, but hadn't, always in difficulties with women. "And, of course, old Miss Parry, wonderful old lady." The crush was terrific for the time of day. Lords, Ascot, Hurlingham, what was it, she wondered, for the street was blocked. The British middle classes, sitting sideways on the tops of omnibuses with parcels and umbrellas, yes, even furs on a day like this, were, she thought, more ridiculous, more unlike anything there has ever been than one could conceive. And the Queen herself held up, the Queen herself unable to pass. Clarissa was suspended on one side of Brook Street, Sir John Buckhurst, the old judge, on the other, with the car between them. Sir John had laid down the law for years and liked a well-dressed woman, when the chauffeur, leaning ever so slightly, said or showed something to the policeman, who saluted and raised his arm and jerked his head and moved the omnibus to the side, and the car passed through. Slowly and very silently it took its way. Clarissa guessed. Clarissa knew, of course. She had seen something white, magical, circular, in the footman's hand, a disc inscribed with a name. The Queen's, the Prince of Wales, the Prime Minister's? Which, by force of its own lustre, burnt its way through. Clarissa saw the car diminishing, disappearing, to blaze among candelabras, glittering stars, breasts stiff with oak leaves, Hugh Whitbread and all his colleagues, the gentlemen of England, that night in Buckingham Palace. And Clarissa, too, gave a party. She stiffened a little. So she would stand at the top of her stairs. The car had gone, but it had left a slight ripple which flowed through glove shops and hat shops and tailors' shops on both sides of Bond Street. For 30 seconds, all heads were inclined the same way, to the window. Choosing a pair of gloves, should they be to the elbow or above it, lemon or pale grey, ladies stopped. When the sentence was finished, something had happened. Something so trifling in single instances that no mathematical instrument, though capable of transmitting shocks in China, could register the vibration. Yet, in its fullness, rather formidable, and in its common appeal, emotional. For in all the hat shops and tailor's shops, strangers looked at each other and thought of the dead, of the flag, of empire. In a public house in a back street, a colonial insulted the House of Windsor, which led to words, broken beer glasses, and a general shindy, which echoed strangely across the way in the ears of girls buying white underlinen threaded with pure white ribbon for their weddings. For the surface agitation of the passing car as it sunk grazed something very profound. What an extraordinary habit that was, Clarissa thought, always playing with a knife. Always making one feel, too, frivolous, empty-minded, a mere silly chatterbox, as he used. But I, too, she thought, and taking up her needle, summoned, like a queen whose guards have fallen asleep and left her unprotected. She had been quite taken aback by this visit. It had upset her, so that anyone can stroll in and have a look at her, where she lies with the brambles curving over her. Summoned to her help the things she did, the things she liked, her husband, Elizabeth, herself, in short, which Peter hardly knew now, all to come about her and beat off the enemy. "Well, and what's happened to you?" she said. So, before a battle begins, the horses paw the ground, toss their heads, the light shines on their flanks, their necks curve. So Peter Walsh and Clarissa, sitting side by side on the blue sofa, challenged each other. His powers chafed and tossed in him. He assembled from different quarters all sorts of things. Praise, his career at Oxford, his marriage, which she knew nothing whatever about, how he had loved, and altogether done his job. "Millions of things," he exclaimed, and, urged by the assembly of powers, which were now charging this way and that, and giving him the feeling at once frightening and extremely exhilarating of being rushed through the air on the shoulders of people he could no longer see, he raised his hands to his forehead. Clarissa sat very upright, drew in her breath. "I am in love," he said. Not to her, however, but to someone raised up in the dark so that you could not touch her, but must lay your garland down on the grass in the dark. "In love," he repeated, now speaking rather dryly to Clarissa Dalloway, "in love with a girl in India." He had deposited his garland. Clarissa could make what she would of it. "In love," she said. That he, at his age, should be sucked under in his little bow tie by that monster. And there's no flesh on his neck. His hands are red. And he's 6 months older than I am. Her eye flashed back to her. But in her heart, she felt, all the same, he is in love. He has that, she felt. He is in love. But the indomitable egotism which forever rides down the hosts opposed to it, the river which says on, 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 even though it admits there may be no goal for us whatever, still on, on, this indomitable egotism charged her cheeks with colour, made her look very young, very pink, very bright-eyed, as she sat with her dress upon her knee and her needle held to the end of green silk, trembling a little. He was in love. Not with her. With some younger woman, of course. "And who is she?" she asked. Now this statue must be brought from its height and set down between them. "A married woman, unfortunately," he said. "The wife of a major in the Indian Army." And with a curious ironical sweetness, he smiled as he placed her in this ridiculous way before Clarissa. "All the same, he is in love," thought Clarissa. "She has," he continued very reasonably, "two small children, a boy and a girl, and I have come over to see my lawyers about the divorce." "There they are," he thought. "Do what you like with them, Clarissa. There they are." And second by second, it seemed to him that the wife of the major in the Indian Army, his Daisy, and her two small children, became more and more lovely as Clarissa looked at them, as if he had set light to a grey pellet on a plate, and there had risen up a lovely tree in the brisk sea-salted air of their intimacy. For in some ways no one understood him, felt with him, as Clarissa did. Their exquisite intimacy. Hugh she detested for some reason. He thought of nothing but his own appearance, she said. He ought to have been a duke. He would be certain to marry one of the royal princesses. And of course Hugh had the most extraordinary, the most natural, the most sublime respect for the British aristocracy of any human being he had ever come across. Even Clarissa had to own that. Oh, but he was such a dear, so unselfish, gave up shooting to please his old mother, remembered his aunt's birthdays, and so on. Sally, to do her justice, saw through all that. One of the things he remembered best was an argument one Sunday morning at Boughton about women's rights, that antediluvian topic, when Sally suddenly lost her temper, flared up, and told Hugh that he represented all that was most detestable in British middle-class life. She told him that she considered him responsible for the state of those poor girls in Piccadilly. Hugh, the perfect gentleman, poor Hugh. Never did a man look more horrified. She did it on purpose, she said afterwards, for they used to get together in the vegetable garden and compare notes. He's read nothing, thought nothing, felt nothing, he could hear her saying in that very emphatic voice which carried so much farther than she knew. The stable boys had more life in them than Hugh, she said. He was a perfect specimen of the public school type, she said. No country but England could have produced him. She was really spiteful for some reason, had some grudge against him. Something had happened, he forgot what, in the smoking room. He had insulted her. Kissed her? Incredible. Nobody believed a word against Hugh, of course. Who could? Kissing Sally in the smoking room. If it had been some Honourable Edith or Lady Violet, perhaps. But not that ragamuffin Sally without a penny to her name and a father or a mother gambling at Monte Carlo. For of all the people he had ever met, Hugh was the greatest snob, the most obsequious. No, he didn't cringe exactly. He was too much of a prig for that. A first-rate valet was the obvious comparison. Somebody who walked behind carrying suitcases. Could be trusted to send telegrams. Indispensable to hostesses. And he'd found his job, married his Honourable Evelyn, got some little post at court, looked after the King's cellars, polished the Imperial shoe buckles, went about in knee breeches and lace ruffles. How remorseless life is, a little job at court. But proportion has a sister, less smiling, more formidable. A goddess even now engaged in the heat and sands of India, the mud and swamp of Africa, the purlieus of London, wherever, in short, the climate or the devil tempts men to fall from the true belief, which is her own, is even now engaged in dashing down shrines, smashing idols, and setting up in their place her own stern countenance. Conversion is her name, and she feasts on the wills of the weakly, loving to impress, to impose, adoring her own features stamped on the face of the populace. At Hyde Park Corner, on a tub, she stands preaching, shrouds herself in white and walks penitentially disguised as brotherly love through factories and parliaments, offers help but desires power, smites out of her way roughly the dissentient or dissatisfied, bestows her blessing on those who, looking upward, catch submissively from her eyes the light of their own. This lady, too, Rachel Warren Smith divined it, had her dwelling in Sir William's heart, though concealed, as she mostly is, under some plausible disguise, some venerable name, love, duty, self-sacrifice. How he would work, how toil to raise funds, propagate reforms, initiate institutions. But conversion, fastidious goddess, loves blood better than brick, and feasts most subtly on the human will. For example, Lady Bradshaw. 15 years ago, she had gone under. It was nothing you could put your finger on. There'd been no scene, no snap, only the slow sinking, waterlogged, of her will into his. Sweet was her smile, swift her submission. Dinner in Harley Street, numbering 8 or 9 courses, feeding 10 or 15 guests of the professional classes, was smooth and urbane. Only as the evening wore on, a very slight dullness, or uneasiness perhaps, a nervous twitch. Fumble, stumble, and confusion indicated what it was really painful to believe, that the poor lady lied. Once, long ago, she had caught salmon freely. Now, quick to minister to the craving which lit her husband's eye so oilily for dominion, for power, she cramped, squeezed, pared, pruned, drew back, peeped through, so that without knowing precisely what made the evening disagreeable and caused this pressure on the top of the head, which might well be imputed to the professional conversation or the fatigue of a great doctor whose life, Lady Bradshaw said, is not his own but his patient's, disagreeable it was. So that guests, when the clock struck 10, breathed in the air of Harley Street even with rapture, which relief, however, was denied to his patients. These hotels are not consoling places. Far from it. Any number of people had hung up their hats on those pegs. Even the flies, if you thought of it, had settled on other people's noses. As for the cleanliness which hit him in the face, it wasn't cleanliness so much as bareness, frigidity, a thing that had to be. Some arid matron made her rounds at dawn, sniffing, peering, causing blue-nosed maids to scour, for all the world as if the next visitor were a joint of meat to be served on a perfectly clean platter. For sleep, one bed. For sitting in, one armchair. For cleaning one's teeth and shaving one's chin, one tumbler, one looking-glass. Books, letters, dressing gown, slipped about on the impersonality of the horsehair like incongruous impertinences. And it was Clarissa's letter that made him see all this. Heavenly to see you! She must say so! He folded the paper, pushed it away. Nothing would induce him to read it again. To get that letter to him by 6 o'clock, she must have sat down and written it directly he left her, stamped it, sent somebody to the post. It was, as people say, very like her. She was upset by his visit. She had felt a great deal. Had, for a moment, when she kissed his hand, regretted, envied him even, remembered possibly, for he saw her look it, something he had said. How they would change the world if she married him, perhaps. Whereas it was this. It was middle age. It was mediocrity. Then forced herself with her indomitable vitality to put all that aside, there being in her a thread of life which, for toughness, endurance, power to overcome obstacles and carry her triumphantly through, he had never known the like of. Yes, but there would come a reaction directly he left the room. She would be frightfully sorry for him. She would think what in the world she could do to give him pleasure, short always of the one thing. And he could see her, with the tears running down her cheeks, going to her writing-table and dashing off that one line which he was to find greeting him. Heavenly to see you! And she meant it. Peter Walsh had now unlaced his boots. But it would not have been a success, their marriage. The other thing, after all, came so much more naturally. Lady Bruton stood by Miss Parry's chair, a spectral grenadier draped in black, inviting Peter Walsh to lunch. Cordial, but without small talk, remembering nothing whatever about the flora or fauna of India. She had been there, of course, had stayed with 3 viceroys, thought some of the Indian civilians uncommonly fine fellows. But what a tragedy it was, the state of India. The Prime Minister had just been telling her. Old Miss Parry, huddled up in her shawl, did not care what the Prime Minister had just been telling her. And Lady Bruton would like to have Peter Walsh's opinion, he being fresh from the centre. And she would get Sir Sampson to meet him, for really it prevented her from sleeping at night, the folly of it, the wickedness, she might say, being a soldier's daughter. She was an old woman now, not good for much. But her house, her servants, her good friend Milly Brush, did he remember her, We're all there, only asking to be used, if they could be of help, in short. For she never spoke of England, but this Isle of Men, this dear, dear land, was in her blood, without reading Shakespeare. And if ever a woman could have worn the helmet and shot the arrow, could have led troops to attack, ruled with indomitable justice barbarian hordes, and lain under a shield noseless in a church, or made a green grass mound on some primeval hillside, that woman was Millicent Bruton. Debarred by her sex, and some truancy, too, of the logical faculty, she found it impossible to write a letter to the Times, she had the thought of empire always at hand, and had acquired from her association with that armoured goddess her ramrod bearing, her robustness of demeanour, so that one could not figure her even in death, parted from the earth, or roaming territories over which, in some spiritual shape, the Union Jack had ceased to fly. To be not English, even among the dead? No, no, impossible. But was it Lady Bruton, whom she used to know? Was it Peter Walsh, grown grey? Lady Rossiter asked herself, who had been Sally Seton. It was old Miss Parry, certainly, the old aunt who used to be so cross when she stayed at Boughton. Never should she forget running along the passage naked and being sent for by Miss Parry. And Clarissa, oh, Clarissa! Sally caught her by the arm. Clarissa stopped beside them. But I can't stay, she said. I shall come later. Wait, she said, looking at Peter and Sally. They must wait, she meant, until all these people had gone. I shall come back, she said, looking at her old friends, Sally and Peter, who were shaking hands, and Sally, remembering the past, no doubt, was laughing. But her voice was wrung of its old ravishing richness, her eyes not aglow as they used to be, when she smoked cigars, when she ran down the passage to fetch her sponge bag, without a stitch of clothing on her, and Ellen Atkins asked, what if the gentleman had met her? But everybody forgave her. She stole a chicken from the larder because she was hungry in the night. She smoked cigars in her bedroom. She left a priceless book in the punt. But everybody adored her, except perhaps Papa. It was her warmth, her vitality. She would paint, she would write. Old women in the village never to this day forgot to ask after your friend in the red cloak who seemed so bright. She accused Hugh Whitbread of all people, and there he was, her old friend Hugh, talking to the Portuguese ambassador, of kissing her in the smoking room to punish her for saying that women should have votes. Vulgar men did, she said, and Clarissa remembered having to persuade her not to denounce him at family prayers, which she was capable of doing, with her daring, her recklessness, her melodramatic love of being the centre of everything and creating scenes. And it was bound, Clarissa used to think, to end in some awful tragedy, her death, her martyrdom. Instead of which, she had married, quite unexpectedly, a bald man with a large buttonhole, who owned, it was said, cotton mills at Manchester. And she had five boys. Gliding across Piccadilly, the car turned down St. James's Street. Tall men, men of robust physique, well-dressed men with their tailcoats and their white slips and their hair raked back, who, for reasons difficult to discriminate, were standing in the bow window of Brooks, with their hands behind the tails of their coats, looking out, perceived instinctively that greatness was passing, and the pale light of the immortal presence fell upon them, as it had fallen upon Clarissa Dalloway. At once they stood even straighter, and removed their hands, and seemed ready to attend their sovereign, if need be, to the cannon's mouth, as their ancestors had done before them. The white busts and the little tables in the background covered with copies of the Tatler and siphons of soda water seemed to approve, seemed to indicate the flowing corn and the manor houses of England, and to return the frail hum of the motor wheels, as the walls of a whispering gallery return a single voice expanded and made sonorous by the might of a whole cathedral. Shawled Moll Pratt, with her flowers on the pavement, wished the